Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And as always, before we jump into the main show, I do have to do some housekeeping. Obviously, if you've listened before, it's our Patreon. It's the way we keep the lights on. It's how we keep the podcast going. So if you do get a moment, please pop over to just patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. It starts from £3 a month. So that's about 10p a day. It's like buying me and Margaret a cup of coffee. And you do get a lot of bonus material over there. You get a bonus episode every single week in the form of our Q&A, which is basically just an extension of the main show. You get that little bit extra. So if it's a topic you really like, you get that little extra sort of 20 minutes on the end where the patrons get the chance to ask their questions. And a lot of the time there is topics or questions that I've just overlooked or missed or just hasn't been covered in depth. It gives that little bit of extra detail to those episodes. You get the whole back catalog of those on the Patreon as well. So it's not kind of like from when you sign up going forward, you get everything that has come before as well. So at this point, there are years of extra content on there. And alongside that, you get the storytime episodes we do with Jonas Lorentzen and Claire Moulet every month and our creator episodes. There's just a ton of stuff. I genuinely think we probably got one of the most stacked Patrons out there. So without waffling on too much, if you can, it's patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. And obviously not everyone can support financially, so even just a like, share, comment, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast would be appreciated. But yeah, let's get into the main show. So today I'm joined by my lovely co-host, who is now becoming, you know, quite the fixture. We can't get rid of you.
I'm here to say.
Yeah,
the time being anyway.
Margaret, no, don't, why have you said that and ruined it now?
No. That's sorry. Ruined the, keep going. I'm sorry. I didn't say that. Scratch it.
That's ruined the whole show now.
Ron will edit it out. Continue.
The lovely Margaret Havgar. Well, no, you know what? I'm going to take the lovely off. I'm just joined by Margaret Havgar. And then our lovely guest, you can have the lovely Nicole.
Oh, thank you.
Is Nicole DeRushy? Is that
DeRushy,
am I right?
Yeah.
DeRushy, yeah. I even struggle when it's the most easy name to say. I still panic and don't back myself. Nicole, can you give us a little intro into who you are and what you do?
Dan, if you got my name right the first time, you'd be the first person in history. So well done for trying. Thank you so much.
See? Exactly. Good job, Dan.
Exactly, yeah,
I did say the flattery goes a long way on here, so you're doing well.
So I am, I do a bunch of stuff. I work in museums where I live in Oxford, and I am a researcher. I'm a maker. I think perhaps the term is scholar practitioner. I'm the kind of person who really likes to deep dive into her hobbies and crafts. Let's put it that way. I've been a hand spinner for most of my life. I've been super involved with outdoor education. I love foraging. I always have to be making something or looking up something. I've just got one of those busy brains. But you know, not content just to do something. I want to look into its background, and I'd love to look at how deep its history goes. And I think that's what's led me to where I am today. And very shortly with Cornucopia Publishing in Sweden, I'll be bringing out a book on the topic that is most close to my heart.
Okay, what's the topic?
The topic is Bronze and Iron Age clothing of Northern and Western Europe and Britain.
Ooh, I love that.
I'm glad that I'm still excited about this topic because I've been writing this thing for quite a while now.
See, that's great, because it's like then you know it's a true passion when it's like you've been working on it since forever, it feels like, and it still gets you like, excited.
Absolutely. Yeah, so excited.
What made you pick a topic that we have almost no archaeological evidence of? Like, I imagine that would make it, it's such a tough topic.
Oh, it absolutely is. I think perhaps one of the reasons that I am so intrigued about it is because there's so little to go on, and it's very fertile ground for creativity and imagination and actually play as well, because you go into this topic not ever expecting to know everything there is to know. In fact, the more you look into it, the more you realize how very little we have. But that's part of the joy. That's part of the excitement. And I think it's what makes people who indulge in experimental archaeology passionate about their topics. And I certainly would put myself in that same box as well.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
Okay. So where is there a starting point that you have in mind where you think we should begin with this talk? Or should we just go with questions?
Gosh, you know what? Let's jump straight into questions. It's all up here. It's all in the head, and I need some help to put it into a structure. I
really like do.
Just a little help.
Margaret, do you have anything off the head you want to go with, or do you want me
to? I guess like a starting point for me would be, since there is so little archaeological evidence, do you have first off, for those who might not be intimately familiar with the topic, there is quite little archaeological evidence. We have a few, but as far as I know, not any like complete costumes, as far as I'm aware. I might be wrong about this. Am I wrong? Please tell me if I'm wrong. That would be so much fun.
I mean, I never like telling people they're wrong, but joyfully, you are wrong.
Yay! I'm so happy to hear that.
Wrong with a massive asterisk next to it, because...
Yeah, that was kind of how I formulated the question as well.
I mean, what we have the vast majority of is tantalizing fragments, right? We don't often get complete garments, complete outfits, as we would know the term today. And when we do have those things, they're very isolated finds. There's really only one area and period from which we have multiple whole outfits, actually, and that would be from sort of early Bronze Age in Denmark, where
bow finds,
oak coffin finds.
Oh, the oak coffins! My bad.
Yes, they're so cool.
They are.
But yeah, that we have just through the miracle of preservation, we've got these fantastic outfits that come from different seasons. It would appear different levels of society, certainly different people, different ages. And it gives us a little window, certainly not a complete picture by any means, but certainly a window that we can look through and start to ask some really interesting questions of.
100%. Oh, that's so cool. Oh, I love that you took me to task on that, because that's exactly what I was hoping for. But so like kind of working off of that, I mean, there's so many follow-up questions you can ask to that, but what I was thinking originally was, for the periods where we don't have kind of oak coffin examples to work off of.
Just to jump in and put a pin in that. What's an oak coffin? And what makes an oak coffin so special when it comes to something being preserved?
Thank you, Dan.
It's a really good question and a great place to start. So,
thank you very much. Thank you for the flattery.
This is going to be a theme, I can tell.
It is, yes.
So an oak coffin burial is pretty much what it says on the tin. Someone who was given something of a status burial, we think at this time, would have had a mature oak tree felled, split in half, hollowed out in the middle, and that two-piece hollowed out trunk would become the coffin that they would lay to rest their relative in. Now that would be a lot of work. We're thinking about a time before we had iron tools, so these would have been probably burnt out, scraped out, chipped out with bronze tools, flint tools. It would have been a huge amount of work. Oak, as you know, is an incredibly tough material, but also very long lasting as well. So we have to think that they put thought into the longevity of that material that they were using for that coffin. So into the hollowed out coffin would be placed the dead person, typically on a skin of a domesticated animal, such as a cow or an ox. They would be laid to rest in there a little bit like they're on a bed. There would be sometimes typically grave goods put in there as well. Things like a bucket of beer, a meal for the journey, perhaps, you know, some spare bits of fabric or tools or things that we need. Perhaps the most famous oak coffin burial of the period in that region in Jutland was the Egdved girl. And she was 17, 18 years old when she went into the ground, and with her actually went the cremated remains of a very young child. And it's not possible to know whether they were related. It's possible that they just wanted this very young person to go on that journey with someone who could guide them. That's you know, one theory that's out there. It didn't necessarily have to be her child or her sibling or something like that. But then
I have so many questions to expand on. I'm so sorry. The first one was, did you say, so this is just like a half of an oak tree?
Half of an oak, that's the bottom. And then everything goes into the middle, maybe another skin over top, tucking them in. And then the other half of the tree would go on top.
It's so bad because all I can think of is a log flume. And I know that's so harsh, but that's all that comes to mind is like this image of like a log flume. But I don't think it's supposed to say.
the two ends are certainly sealed. Like they're not hollowing it out like a tube. They're definitely sealed within the wood itself. And then that whole construction is placed on large stones in the ground, in the middle of a pit, of a dugout area. It's covered over with clay, with you know, further material. It was watered down, really essentially sealing it, and then covered over with a mound. Now, just through the processes of water and time, inside that coffin, you get an incredibly rich tannin environment. And what you essentially are doing is vegetable tanning what's inside. Now, certain kinds of fiber and material get preserved incredibly well in that environment, whereas others disappear completely. So for Eggtread Girl, for example, her clothing that was made of wool, the hair on her head, her fingernails, these things that contain keratin survived because they were tanned essentially within that environment. But her bones disappeared. Everything else disappeared. It's as if she was left a shadow, and only the sort of protein-rich keratinaceous substances that she was buried with survived, as well as, you know, the birch bark boxes that contained her worldly possessions that she was sent off with, and a little bit of metal that was in the grave as well. So it's like a little, it really is like a little time capsule. And it's that sort of thing that gives us such an amazing insight into that world.
Wow. Okay. My other two questions were, you mentioned the cremated remains. I guess, how is it possible to tell what somebody was from their cremated remains? Or was they just not cremated very well? And I know this is a little bit morbid, but I don't know. Maybe this is just my brain. I always just assumed when things were cremated, it was like ash. And I guess, how can you tell?
I suppose there was enough.
Does that make
sense? Yeah, yeah. No, it does make sense. I think there was enough material there that was able to be identified as the bones of a child of about five years old. But that's literally as far as they could guess. You know, those particular aspects of those burials, it's really, really not my area. I was so fascinated by the man-made the goods that she went with that really that's taken my focus. Very cool.
I mean, I can jump in here also and say, like, when it comes to cremated remains, especially back in the day, I think it's like it takes an enormous amount of heat over a long time to actually really burn a body completely. Very and the true. Way that we cremate today is very different. So it's really common that in cremated burials, regardless of the status of the person, like you always have some bits of bone left.
So it's not as efficient, I guess, as we...
Yeah, and also like the amount of fuel you need, the amount of wood or something that you need to sustain that heat for the amount of time. This is something we don't know that much about because obviously the pyre is good. But there is, I mean, I don't know about today's standards, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's like, I mean, today it's like, it's really almost like it is ash, you know, but back in the day it wouldn't necessarily have been just because we do it way differently today. And it's kind of more industrialized. I don't want to say too much about that because that's not my area of expertise. But it's like you see that with food remains, and you also see it with cremated human bodies, that there's usually something left. Like they can only be shards, but then it also depends on the type of testing you do on it. But especially since it's like a child below the age of puberty, you can't really say any other things besides the fact this is a human child, around this age. But biological sex and everything is impossible to tell because the bodies are the same, pretty much.
And in this case, the carbonization actually preserved the bone at all, because they would have disappeared if the child had gone in differently. So,
I don't suppose they probably had the same need for efficiency back then. I guess
I don't know if it is a thing for efficiency either. It could be that the most important thing is to get the body to a certain point.
Hmm. Yeah, but what I mean is today, when we have somebody cremated, we know that it's them, but we don't really want to see that it's them.
And like, also, we have all these rules and regulations to comply to that are made for whatever reason, you know?
But it just being an ash kind of just takes it away from being the thing rather than having like little bits of bone stuck out. Whereas I guess back 1,000 years ago when death was a much more common thing in everyday life, it probably wasn't as kind of gruesome. Whereas for us, it'd be a little bit like, ooh, I don't really want... I know what it is, but I don't want to see.
I don't want to see grandma's hip bone kind of sticking out.
You know what? I wanted to say that, but cool. I wasn't going to, but I'm glad you did, Margaret.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, Nicole, like when you don't have those pieces of clothing left, I'd love to go deeper into the egg threat girl, by the way, and I'll try to see if I can bring up an illustration for the people in the chat that are watching live.
Fabulous.
Because this is, it's just, if people haven't heard of the egg threat girl, it's just, it's mind-blowing. But in the cases where you don't have those types of material to base your work off of, how do you go about it? Like, my immediate assumption would be that you start working around with what we have left of tools or placement of other things in burials. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in thinking that, or what's your kind of approach to this?
I think certainly tools is very helpful. And from the remains, for example, of looms, where perhaps you've had a house collapse and the loom went down with it, you can tell from things like the length of the line of warping weights that, in the case that a warp-weighted loom is used, roughly how wide a piece of material could be made on that loom. And that will lend itself to thinking about what potentially that piece of clothing might have looked like off the loom, because you could see the breadth of it. We know that in some sites around Europe, on the same site, you'll have looms of different sizes. And you get the sense, especially into the Iron Age, that people were weaving pieces of cloth with an end in mind. You know, it's not like cloth weaving on an industrial scale today, where it gets off in reams and reams and reams and reams. We buy roughly the length that we need and then cut it to pieces. This was such an incredibly labor intensive and skill intensive bit of work that you don't want to waste anything of what comes off the loom.
So very meaning often, that every piece of fabric was made with an end purpose in mind?
Initially, certainly people would obviously have reused pieces until there was nothing left to reuse as well. And we've got some very tantalizing finds of pieces that are made of rags, that are repaired extensively, and also things which are ended up as rags, but clearly had a long and storied history before that. But if you are going to have a wrap garment, as seems to be incredibly common both in the Bronze Age and in the early Iron Age, you're going to make it to the size that you initially want that garment to be. So it's going to fit the individual that it's being made for. And
so when you say a wrap garment, is that just as it sounds, a garment that...
Well, the wonderful
thing,
we have so many large pieces of cloth where perhaps we haven't actually got, maybe it's been found without its final wearer, let's say. And I'm thinking here particularly of the Hultramosa II garment, which is an Iron Age, what we might call a peplos today, though that term is going out of fashion. A peplos is a Greek garment made of a tubular piece of cloth that you pin at the shoulders and wear roughly belted around the waist, and it was incredibly popular throughout the Aegean world.
Is that the kind of stereotypical image you see of any Greek person, like drawn, or is that that basically, kind of what I would probably wrongly call a toga? But is that
so? Yeah, the toga was certainly it definitely a wrap garment. It was a large piece of cloth made to measure and then worn, wrapped in a very particular cultural way, and had lots of cultural associations with it. And a peplos, very similarly in the ancient Greek world, would have it's what you see on a huge amount of statuary and in iconographic evidence as well. But it's a term, I think, because that's the association for large tubular garment we have for prehistoric periods generally. It was a term that was originally used quite a lot to refer to the same kind of garment in a Scandinavian or in a Northern European context. Now we tend to just say tubular garment instead, just so that we're not applying the word that specifically relates to a different culture to one here. We don't know what they would have called it. But
and also a different garment, time kind
and
of.
Very different. Well, some crossover, certainly in the Bronze Age, definitely. But how they were worn, not really certain. You know, this is where this is where play and experimentation comes in beautifully, because if you have a large rectangle of cloth, well, how can you wear it? You know, you can actually play around with it and see what works. Certainly, we've had the finds of graves where people have had large squares of cloth wrapped and belted around their waist to wear as a skirt. Or as a sort of a kilt construction kind of thing. Certainly people would have worn them pinned or wrapped around themselves generally as an outer garment. You have Bronze Age men such as the Trintøy man, who was right in that period of early Bronze Age Danish finds, demonstrating a different style of wrap garment, which was, it looked a little bit like a cocktail dress, and belted around the waist as well. So really, it's taking this new medium of weaving on a large scale, cloth that was wearable, and wrapping it and pinning it and belting it and creating garments out of it that didn't overly tailor or damage the cloth so that it could be worn in different ways and could be reused. It would seem that they had the future life of a piece of cloth in mind just as much as whatever it was being currently used for, because it's such a precious commodity.
And it takes so much time, and like the process for production.
It's
insane. Do you want to give us like a rundown of what it takes to just get to the point of weaving?
Oh my goodness.
For people who haven't heard it, because I mean, I can just kind of nap it off the top of my head, but it's cool to hear you say, like, to get to the point where you're sitting and weaving a point of like a piece of cloth, like how many steps have we gone through?
Before we got to that, can I just jump on the last thing, just so we kind of keep things, I don't want to just come back to it. So when we have this like singular piece of cloth that's wrapped around, is that because we're at a point where to make something like a tunic, we've just not advanced to that point yet to be able to make those items? So that's why it's easier to kind of to make something out of like just a rectangular piece of cloth, and then you can wear that. And also, what can we tell if there's any, I'm trying to think how to word it. Is there any emphasis on like covering modesty in the same way that we do today? Obviously, because we wear clothing, obviously, to cover pretty much everything that's deemed like, I guess, like, sexual, maybe
the naughty bits.
Yeah. So you wear like your t-shirt, your trousers. Like it's acceptable to have like legs and arms out for the most part. Does that come into it at all?
These are both really good questions, and I think I'll get to the first one first because it's so exciting if you're a nerd like me. So the wonderful thing about the early Bronze Age finds is that we're looking at a time period when woven cloth was starting to take over from the use of skins, pelts, leather to make clothing from. And we know that people were making clothing out of in very intricate and highly skilled ways out of leather for a very long time before that. And that some of these clothing traditions or patterning traditions may have been used, bringing that forward into this new medium of using cloth. So a really good example of this is something called the Bronze Age, I call it the Bronze Age tea tunic, which is essentially one rectangle of material that has three cuts in it, one T-shaped seam, and it turns it into a three-dimensional shirt, a tunic that you can wear. And we have multiple examples of this, both whole and also fragmentary, from this early Bronze Age period. And I think that because of the overall shape of the cloth that goes into making that garment, that it may have come from an earlier tradition of folding and cutting an animal skin to create the same kind of garment. We know that people have been sewing for a minimum of 50,000 years. Now, if we can just pause and think about that for a second, if you are using a sewing needle today that's pointy at one end and a hole in the other, you're using a bit of technology that really hasn't changed all that much for over 50,000 years.
That's insane.
Because isn't that wonderful?
It's crazy cool.
It's so cool. And we have found as well twined or spliced cordage material that's just as old as well. I'm referring to finds that have been found in France and not that long ago. So people had the know-how and the technology. We have to remember that we're talking about people who are us. They had our brains, mm-hmm. and really, you know, if we think we could figure it out, they were miles ahead of us. You know, we're really standing on the shoulders of giants here, because so many of these fundamental making tools and skills are so old, they're practically in our DNA, you know what I mean? And we've found these incredibly delicate, beautifully formed sewing needles out of bird bones, you know, just a miracle that they've survived this long in their archaeological context, but very fine, beautiful bone needles. Bone needles are one of my favorite tools to make and to use. It's, you know, once you go to a bone needle, it's really hard to go back to using steel needles or any other material. It's such a beautiful thing to work with. People certainly weren't, you know, they weren't slumming it when they were making and using these beautiful tools. They were highly skilled, highly capable societies that were using these things. And they were using them to create clothing. If you look at Ötzi the Iceman, perhaps one of the most famous sort of Chalcolithic finds, who was found in a glacier with a full set of clothes, intricately stitched together from goatskin, sheepskin, all sorts of materials that would have been local and readily available to him. Some very well-fitting leggings, he had a coat on, you know, all of these sewing and tailoring skills were there already. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that as we move later on in time, we see a little bit less of that tailoring in the finds that we have remaining to us, and more sort of broader shapes where tucking and folding and pleating became the way to shape and form these pieces of cloth. That's not to say that they may not have also been creating tailored shirts and things like that, but in the context of survival, typically in bogs and in oak coffin burials where wool gets preserved quite well, linen garments, hemp garments, garments made of nettle, any plant fiber will disappear. Mm. So their undergarments, Huldramosa woman is a really good and very famous example of this. Her skin garment, her skin cloaks, her woolen scarf, her woolen skirt all survive beautifully well, but the plant fiber undergarment that she would have been wearing, which almost certainly had sleeves, was about knee length, disappeared. There's just the faintest traces on her skin of the imprint of that fabric.
Oh, so that's how we know that it's missing, kind of.
Yeah. And little traces of fiber as well, but nothing enough to say, oh, this is what her shirt looked like or anything like that.
Yeah. Mm.
Would it have been plant fiber to make you more comfortable? Because obviously anybody who's had wool against their skin, it's a little bit itchy.
It is, but I think we're so unused to wearing it as well that we're very, very sensitive to wool today.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I maybe I'm weird, and I know I'm weird. I'm answering my own question here.
We're all weird.
It's I can wear wool against the skin, and it doesn't bother me whatsoever, but I've been doing it for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Certainly, a plant fiber garment would make that more comfortable, would add extra layers for warmth and things. It was also easier to wash. Okay. So it was, no doubt, a matter of cleanliness as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious.
And a sign of status, too.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm also just kind of curious. I'm just wildly speculating here, but especially also here kind of in the kind of colder climates, at least during certain points of the year, I'm also wondering if it could, in addition to all the other things, also help out with like just layering.
Absolutely.
In the sense that it would help you contain the heat if you wear an inner garment. And if that inner garment then is of, it wouldn't necessarily matter what it is made out of since they didn't have plastic fibers at this time. Mm-hmm. But any like multiple layers of garments would help you retain heat.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you know, if we would think, oh, it's very cold, I better put on more than one piece of clothing. You know, that's not a modern thought.
No.
If you had it, you would wear it, you know, in the coldest weather, you'd certainly layer up. And we do have some finds that demonstrate layering of clothing in the way that you say. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's that as well. Linen and wool have very, very different properties and would behave very differently against the skin and would give you options. So yeah, there's lots of reasons why they would have done that. And we know that they did, if they could.
Okay, before we jump back to Margaret's question about like the production, do you think that if sewing was a thing beforehand, is it likely that it was just a fashion choice that they went back to these kind of like, I say back, I don't know, but to these like simple rectangular pieces of cloth that required tucking and folding, and then also the modesty thing.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
I want to know about that.
Well, I mean, this is an area of again, wild speculation, and who knows, maybe. But the wonderful thing about it is that we have no definitive answer for you there. You know, but what can we surmise? We look at a piece of cloth that is large, and we know that it, you know, if a small piece of cloth is a lot of work to make, it's additionally a huge amount of work to make a large one. Larger garments, broader breadths of cloth would have been much richer materials. You know, if it, either time expensive for your community to make, for your household to make, or it would have cost you a great deal if that was something that you were buying from a trader in a marketplace, or you know, trading between communities. So potentially a sign of status, of wealth, of plenty, that you have a larger garment, that you have so much, you've got to gather it into pleats to bring it about yourself. Certainly in later periods, excessive amounts of cloth were worked into very fashionable garments because you're showing off just how much you can afford to have on your body at one time, you know. So that's a potential for sure. It could also be the clothing traditions of particular communities. And this is how we dress. This is how my mom dressed. This is how I'm going to dress. It's how I'm going to dress my kids. Tradition was an incredibly powerful thing at this time. This is how people learned, how people passed things along. So you have clothing traditions that would be incredibly long lived. You know, it wasn't sort of every 6 months, the fashion is different the way that we have today. There would have been shapes and concerns and methods that would stay with people generation after generation.
Yeah, and it may have started off as being based on one thing and then it's continued because this is the way that we do it.
Yeah.
So like the original kind of thought behind it, it's not that it disappeared, but it wasn't necessarily perhaps on the top of everyone's mind because of course we're going to do it this way because this is the way we've always done it.
Absolutely right. So modesty.
Oh. Yeah, I'm so sorry, Margaret.
Do you have another question?
I do. Margaret, I'm so sorry. We will get to it. I just keep getting these questions in my mind.
That's great.
And I feel like they're most people would want to know the answer to them. When it comes to, again, to this, you said... So this idea of, like, again, the rectangular piece of fabric, is Do we find that in Northern Europe as well, or is that, because I know you mentioned in Greece, and I was wondering whether it could be a temperature thing. If, you know, in the warmer climates, you know, it's a little bit more breathable, whereas maybe you wouldn't use that in Scandinavia. Do we find those?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, absolutely. We find large rectangular garments wherever we find textile remains, basically.
Okay.
And we also, you know, this is the material culture. These are the archaeological finds that we have. But we've also got a little bit of written evidence, certainly for the later Iron Age, by, of course, Romans coming and visiting Germanic areas, Celtic areas, and describing the locals and what they were wearing. Not always in the most flattering terms. Believe it or not, they may have felt a little bit superior to the people they were viewing. But, you know, these are sort of, this is tantalizing evidence of how things were worn, and not necessarily what everyone was wearing every day, but certainly the people who were encountering Romans and what stood out to Romans that it was worthy of mention. So in the later Iron Age, for example, you get the sense that certainly dignitaries, people of higher status, were wearing very colorful clothing with garish color combinations that perhaps today would make our eyes bleed a little bit, but seemed to be quite the fashion in these sort of bordering regions where the Romans were making themselves felt present. We know that people were wearing colorful cloaks and they would wear flashy pins, you know, and things like that. They would wear closely fitting trousers and short tunics that only just sort of came mid thigh, that kind of, you know, these wonderful, broad, but very useful descriptions for telling us what people were wearing at that time. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, in this entire discussion, we've got to keep in mind that the examples that I'm talking about are hundreds or sometimes over 1,000 years apart. Prehistory is very, very deep, and we have so little to go on that we can only ever talk in broad strokes about any one part of that massive prehistory.
Wonderful. Okay, modesty.
Yes.
Let's get to that. And then, Margaret, you can have the floor.
Let's go, modesty.
It is such a fascinating question, and it's one that came to the forefront quite recently for me, because back in October, I put a post on Instagram that, what do they call it? It went viral, I suppose.
Okay, yeah.
I know. And nice. What I had posted was my reconstruction of the Egg-Fed Girl's outfit, which I had hand spun and woven and modeled in this short educational video. The Egg-Fed Girl was found wearing one of these tea tunics, which was a short-sleeved, modest top, but, you know, a bit of a scoop neckline, and it would have been short. It would have shown her belly, okay? She was also wearing, and this is probably the most sensational garment found in the early Bronze Age in Denmark, she was wearing a string skirt. Ooh, now, let me describe what I mean by a string skirt.
Please all right.
So this was a skirt that was made of wool, and it was a garment that combined a number of fiber crafts in it to create what we were seeing in this string skirt, which was complete in the coffin. It wasn't fragmentary like so many things, so we really know exactly what it looked like. It had a woven band, you know, maybe a couple of fingers deep, that went around her waist. And from this waistband were these really densely twined strings. The strings would have been, would have made the whole skirt fall to about mid thigh, and they were gathered at the bottom edge with a string that ran through loops at the bottom of each of the strings. So it wasn't in the sort of hula skirt, sort of free swinging kind of picture. It was very contained. So the strings would have been held in place, held at the top, held at the bottom. The strings are very dense, quite heavy, and they would lie quite close against the body. And this
would they run vertical or
they
like,
were running vertical?
Okay,
yeah,
because I'm thinking vertical. Of like a crisscross.
Oh
like,
yeah, like no, a, absolutely straight okay. down, and the skirt was long enough so that it could wrap twice around her middle before she tied it off. Okay, so that ends up you end up then with a double layer of strings. So quite a density of strings. Mm-hmm. And if you're just stood there, you don't see anything. There's you can't see past the strings. The strings are all covering. But as soon as you move, right. you get little glimpses of thigh underneath, that kind of thing. And we've got these gorgeous little statues of the period as well, apparently of dancers or acrobats wearing what looks very much like one of these string skirt garments. The Egghead Girl's skirt was not the only one of its kind ever found. Quite a number of these garments have been found, either mostly whole or just fragmentary. But we definitely get the sense that this was a common style to the region, to the period. It may have had ritual significance. It may have been worn for dance, for particular kinds of celebration or observation where people were free to move. We know that the Egghead Girl was buried in summer because of the contents of the bier that she was buried with and the fact that she had yarrow flowers strewn all around her in her coffin. It makes a really amazing dramatic picture. But, you know, was she wearing what might have been a common summer garment, because that would have been quite breezy, you know, lots of airflow in the little string skirt. Was it something that only women of a certain status or a certain age wore? These are all huge questions that we don't know the answer to. But would it have been modest? Absolutely not by our standards. But perhaps there was some element of controlled modesty going on for the context where that string skirt was worn.
Oh, that's fascinating, because there, especially in modern times, there is plenty of things that people wear that others may not consider modest, others are consider acceptable.
Absolutely.
It brings to mind the whole, like, what even is modesty?
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah. Honestly. And,
yeah.
I'll tell you what, when I was posting on this back in October, it got a lot of attention, and it got the kind of attention that suddenly the comment section becomes really, really interesting. And there was
people who think that they know better.
Well, certainly that. don't get me wrong. A huge number of very interested, you know, supportive people who were just loving seeing the reconstruction. But there was a whole subsection debating, and it wasn't to do with the string skirt necessarily. It was to do with the bare midriff.
Really?
There were people losing their minds over the idea that a teenager back in the Bronze Age was letting her belly show, and a whole number of people going, but of course she was a teenager, and it was summertime, she's going to let her belly show. And a lot of people saying, oh, it wouldn't have shown, the garments that you're wearing are too small for you, she would have been a much smaller person and it would have covered her belly, as if I was wearing her garments and not something that I had made to fit me.
I love that.
Hilarious stuff. But there was this obsession over her midriff in the comment section that just went on and on and on. And the whole concept of modesty was very much at the center of this. People thinking, oh, there's no way that in a traditional society like that, she would have been allowed to show her belly. And others going, actually, in lots of traditional cultures, people show their belly all the time. And it just kind of went on from there. It was fascinating.
I feel like some people look back at history like they're also prudish. Like there was just everybody just like was very plain and simple, and
yeah, we have this kind of notion of almost obsessively kind of putting people from way back when, irregardless of kind of culture or time period, of like making them fit into our perception of what modesty is or what clothing is or what roles are or age, and like kind of just all kind of spirals from there. It was really interesting when you said that, Nicole, because I did, just while you were explaining the outfit, I did a quick Google search to see what kind of illustrations of this outfit were available. And I found a pretty good one from National Geographic that I can display if you let me share screen, Dan.
Oh, yeah,
but I also
absolutely.
Came across a picture that looked like it was taken in maybe the 60s.
Yeah, there's a couple of really
the source wasn't great, so I don't want to show that picture because I don't know where it comes from, but it showed the exact same outfit except the shirt is to her waist and the skirt is to almost below her knees. And I was like, that looks like the 60s to me.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think certainly a little bit after that, there were some very accurate, beautiful reconstructions done for the National Museum in Copenhagen, which you can actually go and see on display there. And it's a wonderful element of their prehistory galleries. Yeah, that's a great one there. Look how happy she is to be wearing.
That looks so modern. I feel like I could go out on a Saturday night and see somebody in that.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look too far away from what someone could wear today, except maybe the belt buckle is a bit intense. But the belt buckle is also really cool.
That looks just like 90s to me, though.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's like your 2000s. Battle armor you got going on there. So I remember reading a quote from someone who was doing a reconstruction of this outfit and wore it, because why wouldn't you? And obviously. I remember her commenting that when she just put the skirt on, she felt quite vulnerable because strings, but as soon as she put the belt on with the bronze sun disc, she said that feeling of vulnerability instantly went away. That just something
That's
about that weight there, that presence, that audacious display of bling, and she suddenly felt powerful instead. And you can imagine someone putting this outfit on, perhaps to go and dance in a midsummer celebration or something like that, and really sort of psyching themselves up for an amazing good time by what they were wearing.
I don't know if this is relative or not, but I've wore kilt a few times. And
good on you, Dan.
And every time but I always feel like it doesn't feel right until you put the sporran on, which I feel is quite
very similar.
Something there, maybe I've been a guy, just been a little bit different, but that thing, like, just there, kind of the weight of it just makes it complete. And I don't know if maybe, again, being a guy, that having that sporran there kind of weighs the front down, so you don't feel as, because obviously if I'm wearing a kilt, I'm wearing it traditional. So anybody out there who's asking themselves that, it is traditional. I guess it kind of weighs things down in those regions that maybe make it feel a little bit more secure.
I think you're onto something there. Yeah, definitely.
Maybe.
Definitely.
Okay, so we're gonna let Margaret ask about the production. But also, Nicole, are you in a rush this evening?
No. I'm not in a rush at all.
Because we're not far off coming up to nearly an hour as it is. And we don't have a bonus episode after tonight, Margaret. So I figured we could just hang out with Nicole a little bit longer if you have the time as well, Margaret.
Yeah, sure. I'm probably going to have to leave right around 8:30 my time. So
half an hour-ish?
Yeah, half an hour-ish.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can just make the main show a little bit longer rather than... So,
absolutely.
Yeah, because I feel like we've hardly even touched the surface, and there's so much I still want to know. Okay, Margaret, you go ask. I'm just going to quickly run for the little boy's room. But you ask, and I'll just jump back in when I get there. Ron can edit that out, or don't edit out, whatever.
Please don't edit it out.
But, human nature, sometimes we got to go.
This is true. We're talking about nature today.
We are, yeah. We're being very open.
So, also, going to the bathroom in that string skirt must have been just a breeze.
Oh, yeah.
Literally.
Absolutely. Oh, it would have been very easy if you were a guy, though.
Yeah. And for us girls as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, now I want one of those skirts. Just for the ease of it.
And with only 87 hours of work, it could be yours.
Exactly.
Oh, that's made me think. I do. Once Margaret's asked about the production, I do want to ask about, like, men and skirts. Because that's one that I see popping up all the time. And whether
Let's do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll get back to that one. Okay, I will be back in 2 moments. You guys just carry on.
Keep on going, yeah.
Hold the fort.
I was really curious to get your take on kind of the I mean, the production line is one thing, but also just kind of like, what's it called? Kind of just in black and white terms, just kind of laying out all the steps needed to get. Because I remember kind of becoming more, learning a lot more about textile production specifically about 2 years ago when I started my current PhD project. And I was kind of thrown into this world of textile that I hadn't really been that intimately familiar with before, and just kind of learning about all of it. So I'm thinking, like, for our audience, it would be really interesting, because I think also with just, I mean, with the most other things today, we're not really, are you still with us, Nicole?
Oh yeah, totally here.
There for a second.
I'm still here.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Okay.
It's probably just my internet. We're so removed from the production side of it all.
Absolutely
that it,
right.
it kind of, we're just, it's not that we're any less smart or anything. It's just, we don't deal with it. So we don't think about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. No,
and
you're
I don't
right.
think I've ever really appreciated the amount of work that goes into getting just a piece of fabric. So, I mean, it's up to you whether you want to do it from the plant fiber aspect or the more animal fiber. So if the
sure.
textile comes from a plant or from an animal, but just kind of laying out the steps of, like, before you even get to sitting down and weaving something, what needs to happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I just want to come back to what you were saying there about our appreciation for that skill set. So much of it now, well, all of it practically, except for the earliest stages of production, is mechanized.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot appreciate, I think, the amount of work that would have gone into it without looking at how people did it in the past. The you know, when
exactly.
we recreate garments today, even when we're trying in other ways to be as accurate as possible with our reconstructions, you know, perhaps we are being a part of a living history display, we're a reenactor or something like that. We're still starting from cloth that came off of a machine. Unless, you know, in those rare moments, people have actually made it themselves or have had it made. Now, that's not to say that people back in the Bronze Age and in the Iron Age weren't buying fabric as well. They absolutely were, because it was a very tradable commodity. It doesn't go bad. It doesn't try to run away. You know, it's transportable. It's, you know, it's everything that you want in a tradable good. And we know there was trade. But when you're creating it for the first time yourself, you are going through so many processes, like you said before, the final product. Let's take wool, for example, because that's a little bit more straightforward. When you're looking at plant fiber, there's a whole bunch of processes that go into creating spinnable fiber from what grows out of the ground. There's retting and scutching and heckling and all these wonderful things.
Yep.
But for wool, and wool is certainly the dominant material, because it's much easier to make cloth out of wool. You have to raise your sheep. Obviously, you've got to keep
first
your wool.
Step sheep.
First step, have a sheep. And the sheep, not every sheep gives really good wool for spinning. So this was something that was bred into sheep from a very, very long time ago. Today we have certain breeds which more closely resemble ancient breeds. The Icelandic sheep is a really good example. The Shetland sheep is a really good example. Breeds that have Outer Hebridean, breeds that have a slightly hairier, almost goat-like coat, and a double coat where they've got a soft woolly inner bit and a sort of protection against the weather, hairier outer bit. These are closer. So the process could even have begun with separating out the fleece itself, once you've shorn the wool off the sheep, into whether you want to comb that two different fiber types together or whether you want to separate them because you want to use them differently for different kinds of fabric. But once you've shorn the sheep, that fleece needs to be cleaned, it needs to be skirted, it needs to obviously be nice and dry. You've got to comb it, which you can do in lots of different ways. We don't have too many combs remaining in the archaeological record. These could have been made out of thorns driven into a wooden paddle. It could have been made once there was metalworking, or perhaps using bone or wooden teeth, a comb that would be used to tease those fibers apart, because the locks of wool, they just want to bunch together. They're doing what wool does best, which is to lock together to keep the sheep nice and warm and dry in bad weather. So we've got to fight against that natural tendency so that it can reform together into string when we spin it. So we have to comb all the fleece. We've got to get it ready for spinning in that sense. And then the spinning itself, which was a long process. But it's something that, and again, for thousands of years, people would have been doing from a very young age. They would have been doing it sometimes professionally, you know, that would have been their one job in the community because that's what they did. In other sort of contexts of household production, it's what you would have done in between other things when the light was too low to do anything else, or you had to sit and watch the pot, so you might as well do some spinning. You could spin with a baby on your knee. You could do it while you were feeding the goats. Do it, you know. It's one of those excellent crafts for the multitasker.
Recording a podcast, Magrath.
For example, there you go.
For anybody who listens every week, crocheting, am I right?
Yep.
Magrath sits here crocheting lovely items.
Brilliant. No, it's so true. Fiber craft is one of those things that just lends itself to doing while you do other things. Talking, gossiping, you know, watching, making sure the kids are safe, because that's the thing. And we have to remember that anything which was dominantly a woman's craft, and I think we have enough evidence to suggest that the world of spinning and weaving was dominantly a female craft throughout prehistory. Not to say that men didn't take part. They almost certainly did. But the iconography, the sources that we have do place it fairly strongly into the women's court. Anything that a woman would be doing is something that she would be doing while she was also doing a dozen other things that she could, you know, handle while her household was, you know, in chaos around her. So I like to keep that picture in mind whenever I have a quiet moment to spend, just, you know, what else could I be doing right now? Watching the fire, making sure the sheep don't run away. So spinning is a wonderful craft that we've been doing for thousands of years with lots of different kinds of tools. Early in the Bronze Age, we don't get so much in a Northern European context, so much evidence of spindle whorls in the way that we have a little bit later on. That is basically like a donut of stone or clay or wood that you put a dowel through that would act with a centrifugal spin to help you twist your fiber into a thread. They may have used a spinning hook. That's quite possible, where you are using a stick with a little hook on the end to just add tension to that fiber while you roll that stick along your thigh, adding twist into the fiber that you then, and then you use that same stick to roll the finished yarn up onto it. The spinning is what would have taken the longest time for any piece of weaving. The weaving was really the last step, and it was the quickest step. You needed to do a huge amount of spinning in advance in order to warp the loom. You know, I recently did, I spun and wove a rectangular piece of cloth for a Bronze Age impression that I'll be looking to give this summer. And just to warp a loom for a 2 meter piece of cloth took, what was that? 500 meters of fiber. So there's a lot of work, and you've not even started going crossways. That's just the
and that's warp. Just for this thing right here, the thread.
That is just for that part of it. And this was really chunky as well. This is a chunky cloth. It's not the fine stuff. It's to represent the coarser end of what was being produced in Britain in the Bronze Age. But we do know from the recent, and if you haven't yet read them, you absolutely must start reading the archaeological reports from Must Farm that were published a couple of weeks ago.
I haven't.
Oh, my heavens. So one of the most wonderful, mind-blowing facts that came out of this this report from Must Farm, which is in the east of Britain, the Cambridge Archaeological Unit unearthed this incredible site of a Bronze Age settlement that had been built, roundhouses on stilts over the wetland that had burnt and fallen into the water, and the carbonization and submersion preserved, in this case, all of the linen textiles that they had been making on the site, and the finest piece of cloth that they found, just a very small fragment of it, had 30 warp threads per centimeter. This was linen, finer than a human hair. For those of you
who don't know, that's wow. That's craftsmanship on a different scale.
That is as good as any linen that has been found anywhere in Europe from that period. And, you know, until you have that evidence, you go, oh, but did they make linen? We think so. We think we've got some evidence for it.
And then the Must Farm comes along and goes, yes.
and gives everyone goosebumps, because suddenly there it is. And that was the finest, but there were materials of lots of different gauges. It's such an exciting thing now to finally, after so many years of anticipation, be reading about in depth and detail, certainly a topic for a different day. You could talk for years about Must Farm. It's absolutely fabulous, but it's our best source of information on plant fiber weaving and textile traditions in Europe from the Bronze Age, by far.
Mm-hmm. Crazy,
so cool!
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
Dan with his little smile question. Just going, Mags is just having a nerd moment.
I saw how excited you got then.
Whoa.
See, the joy on your face made me happy then. I was like, what? Yeah.
Because okay. I've heard of the Must Farm, but I wasn't aware that the reports had been released.
Yeah.
And now you getting into the details of it made my brain just explode.
It's like 3,000 pages of joy, honestly. Oh. I've not read it all, but I've certainly taken a pretty good look at it. You know, going to Crazy. The good bits, of course.
Yeah. Are they open access? Do you know?
Yes, it's all open access with amazing images as well.
Ooh.
So definitely worth looking up for sure. Yeah. So cool.
I'm so excited.
To answer your question very shortly, lots and lots of time, huge amounts of skill, lots of processes. So cloth was an incredibly precious thing, and people treated it as such.
Mm-hmm. Is it likely that most of them were brightly colored? Because I feel like most people have this idea when they look back in history, particularly probably like the Viking Age, medieval period, Bronze Age, as it's just been very monotone, and everything's been very monochromatic. Is that the right word?
Yeah. Different shades of like brown and
yeah.
And whites and yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I love brown so much.
Absolutely. So
it depends on when we're talking about. Certainly in the later Iron Age, it would be fair to say that people did enjoy brightly colored clothing. And if they could, they wore it. Of Iron Age finds, I'm just trying to remember my research now. It would seem that almost all Iron Age clothing or textile finds that were able to yield results when put to study revealed that they had been dyed somehow with some process. Woad, to give a really beautiful blue, was incredibly popular and widely used, but often in combination with other dyes that would have yielded some shade either side to green or purple. So blue was not necessarily always the desired end color. It could have been overdyed with something that would provided a yellow dye to create a green, or with lichens, or with imported matter that would have given it more of a purplish edge to it as well. Yellow was certainly really, really common. Green seems to have been a desirable color. And then reds, rusts, oranges, a little bit of that going on too, though not as much as sort of blues through greens, it would seem, from what we can tell. But, you know, our ability to test and to see what colors existed there are limited to a degree, and are improving as our technology to test improves. A lot of this research was carried out in the last 20 years by the Textile Research Center in Copenhagen, looking at particularly at Danish textile finds. I should preface that by saying that we're looking at the traditions there specifically in Denmark, but more broadly, it would seem, and also according to our Roman sources, that people in Britain loved colorful clothing as well. The earlier in time you get, it would seem that dye technology was not necessarily there yet in any way that we can test, given that the sample pieces are so much older and any evidence is likely to have faded. At this point, we really haven't got evidence of a dyeing coloring culture for the Bronze Age. They probably would have been mostly sheep colored, but keeping in mind that white was at that point a very rare color for sheep, you would have had a variety of browns and grays and almost blacks that you would have had. So there would have been variety. And it's possible that they would have used earth-based pigments as well, perhaps to color it in ways that don't survive either. But people love to decorate themselves. You know, people were image proud in that way, yeah, just as they were later in history. And I think we've got lots of evidence of people making sure that they looked good and that they were expressing themselves with their clothing. And whether that's with color or with other means, mm-hmm, people have always found a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned blacks. Was that common or possible? Because I remember once reading somewhere that this is kind of, in much more modern times, the whole reason that we wear black for funerals and things was because it's such a hard color to make, so it would be your most expensive item, so therefore you would wear it to a funeral because it's the show of respect. Is that first of all, is that true? And then does that kind of relate back through history? Do we get like black colored clothing items? Because obviously black today is the most common. So if we ever make a t-shirt through Hornsboden, if it's not black, it's not selling. It's frustrating as hell because I like other colored clothing. But for the most part, black clothing just sells.
Absolutely. I should have put a massive star next to when I said black. I don't mean the sort of pitch black the way that we have it, but
wool black. You did say almost black.
Yeah,
so
wool black, sort of a very dark brown. Of course, if you put something like a woad dye over that, you could achieve a very dark color as well. If you want to create black fabric out of other fibers like cotton, silk, linen, that is a much more complicated process. And it's certainly true that later in history, black was a very rich color. There were even sumptuary laws against people of lower status wearing that kind of cloth because it was not reflective of their status in society, kind of thing. Okay. But since forever, now there's a highly historically accurate term. people have worn near black that is achievable by spinning and weaving with black wool, near black wool, sheep wool.
Okay. There we go. Margaret, have you got anything else before we move on to men and skirts? And
then yes, of course I do, but not for the necessarily, like I could go on forever, but I think we should move on to men.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do that and we can wrap up after that and then let the patrons ask you some questions. So yeah, just this idea of the men wearing skirts. It's one that I see kind of challenged time and time again. And what do we have to show either way?
Certainly, we have bodies of men wearing skirts from that early Bronze Age period in the Jutland Peninsula. A man from the Borm Eshoy family, who were a 14th century group of people who were buried on the Jutland Peninsula, was wearing essentially a knee-length skirt, a rectangle of cloth wrapped around his middle, tied with a bit of rope. a bit of string around the middle as a belt. And that was the garment for the lower half of his body. We don't have evidence of trousers as we know the term until much later in the Iron Age. And we think that that became much more common when people were riding horses. And I don't think you need to stretch your imagination too far to see why wearing trousers while riding horses would have been preferable. Mm-hmm. But that also doesn't necessarily mean that trousers was a men-only garment. We do have later Iron Age trousers, which some in the past have theorized were actually made for a young girl or a very slender woman based on their proportions around the sort of crotchular area. They think no man will ever fit into these. These must have been made for a girl.
Okay.
But
I feel like that's something that a man wrote. He's like, no way, we could never get in these.
Exactly right.
I love it when the stereotypes then flips the narrative the other way.
Yeah.
No, so we do have a number of trouser finds from the later Iron Age. These were the ones that we have found have been typically sort of breeches length. Later on into the later Scandinavian Iron Age, into the Viking Age, certainly you get a full length, well-fitted trousers, which are reproduced all over the place for reenactors and things like that. But for earlier on, we've got the Marx Etzel trousers or breeches, which were found in the early 19th century in southern Germany. These were a pair of trousers that had a very wide waist. They were folded or rolled at the waist to fit them, and then they fell to about the knee. So we do have this. We've got the fact that towards the end of the Roman Empire, trousers were banned from the city of Rome. No Roman citizen was allowed to wear trousers, clearly showing that they'd become quite popular. They were considered a barbaric thing, and that only barbarians wore trousers. But soldiers traveling through regions where they were quite a common garment loved it and wore them, and actually wore them too much, according to the emperors at the time. But if you think about how to dress yourself very simply, if you think about preserving your modesty, keeping warm, keeping clean, keeping dry, really wrapping a bit of cloth around your skirt, around your waist, and tying it off with a belt, is just such a universally simple way of dressing yourself. And it seems to have been there in prehistory for quite a while. But again, we have to preface this by saying we have so few finds. And even in iconographic representations of people from these early centuries, so often they're shown wearing their outerwear, you know, this beautiful cloak with a beautiful fringe on the edge or something like that, that it completely obscures what they might have been wearing underneath. So you can't even necessarily tell from these things either. Yeah, it's one of those big, who knows, it depends. It's wonderful to ask the questions, but we have too few finds to know what any definitive answers are.
Perfect. Wonderful. Okay, yeah, let's wrap this up and then we'll let people ask you some questions, and then, yeah, we'll let you get on about your day. This has been fascinating.
So much fun.
Thank you. Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed this.
Same.
Is there anywhere that you want to point people towards? I don't know whether you're active on social media or not. Or
absolutely. So I'm actually really inactive on social media, but I do have an Instagram page, grounded_history, which is where I post usually every couple of days, certainly every week, on what I'm up to. If people are interested in the book when it does finally come out, which should be later on this year, updates will be first available there. So that's quite a lot of fun. And I do enjoy putting posts together for that. My publisher, Chronocopia Publishing, who you may know as the publishers of An Early Meal about Viking Age cookery from a number of years ago, they have recently set up a Facebook page, which will be offering early release information, any information about the book as it becomes available. If people want updates and they're not necessarily on my Instagram, then they are welcome to go and check that page out. And just before we started recording today, I did send that through as a message on Instagram. Just the link there to that Facebook page. So if you're able to post that somewhere, that would be fantastic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so those are the places to go to for information about the book that will be coming out later this year, about everything that we've been talking about today and more. It's going to have quite a number of final numbers still to be determined. I've written too much. We may need to chop it down a bit. Instructions and patterns for recreating pieces of prehistoric clothing, as well as making things, making tools, learning about the processes, learning about the sources. It's sort of a one-stop shop if you're a prehistory nerd for clothing and textiles.
Lovely.
Wonderful. Margaret, where can people find you?
Instagram, as always, if you're interested. So that's Archeomags, Archeo with a K.
There we go. And if you want to follow me, it's Daniel_Farrand1 or at Horns of Odin, and then just the podcast anywhere, whether it's Facebook, YouTube, all the different places, just Nordic Mythology Podcast. But wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's so much fun.